When Harrison reported back to him, he released the packages. And we got about 1,200 packages, 50, 60, 70 pounds. And we brought them all, almost all. We had more than enough for St. Etienne. And we had enough packages left over, hundreds, to take to other displaced persons camps in the area. There are two St. Etienne's. And many people talk about the St. Etienne Hospital as one hospital. It wasn't. Between May and November or December of 1945, it was a place of death. It was a place of starvation. But after Eisenhower was ordered by Truman to change policy, in early 1946, it became a model hospital. And by 1948, as some of you know, some of you were here, it was a model hospital. So when people say, well, I was treated well at St. Etienne. They were here in 46, yes. But they're here in 45, not likely. Now, I've been making speeches literally all over the world about this. But it's history. It's past history. Yes, we feel emotion when we hear about this, when we think about this, particularly if our families were somehow related to what went on here. But what does it mean for today, for the future? That's what's important. What do we learn from what happened in St. Etienne in the immediate post-war years that can make a difference today? I lecture a lot to school children. And I say to them, you had two young soldiers who had no power, no influence, no status. They saw something wrong in their society, and they tried to do something about it. And they didn't know they would succeed. And I say, you have bullies in your schoolyard? So you sit back and say, what can I do? You try to do something, and maybe you'll win. And you know, I can still see the faces of the survivor children begging, these poor faces, children begging, give me some place to go, let me have a life, let me find a life. And I see the same faces today. Children from Asia, the children from Africa, and the children from Mexico, begging, please, take us in so we can have a life. And you know, it astounds me that there are people who are saying, shut the borders. Let the children go back to starvation and murder and rape. And all of us here, every one of you and me, are in a position to at least try to do something that we see is unfair or wrong in our society today. So if my experience at St. Etienne, and if your experience at St. Etienne means anything, it means making the world today a little better to the best of your ability. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Robert, for your speech. I think we'll skip the difficult questions and go directly to the audience. But maybe there's one question before, because after reading your book, you were very critical with the American army and with the American government in 45, 46. We talked about that before. You even accused Eisenhower of not being, put it mildly, a friend of the Jews.
Well,
I'm
not so sure he was not a friend of the Jews, but as some of you know, Dr. Gredberg organized some of the other heads of displaced persons camps in the area, and they wrote, I have documents from him, they wrote to Eisenhower at least twice, detailing the problem and asking for help. They received no response whatsoever. It was totally ignored. Now, one could say, okay, Eisenhower, the war was over by then, but Eisenhower was concerned with many more things that he had to do. Maybe, maybe not. But if you're asking me about Eisenhower, and some of you Americans here might consider Eisenhower a great president, but that was my first relationship to Eisenhower. I mean, what kind of man would threaten two young soldiers for trying to help people? But later on, when Eisenhower was running for president, I gave him the benefit of the doubt. But some of you know about so-called McCarthyism in the United States in the late 1940s and early 1950s. A senator by the name of Joe McCarthy was accusing everybody he wanted to of being a communist, and there was a red under every bed in the United States, because it was guilt by accusation, literally, under Joe McCarthy's, under so-called McCarthy's. You could write an anonymous letter to the company that somebody who didn't like worked for and say, I think this man associates with communists. And he'd be fired the next day. Well, Eisenhower allowed McCarthy to decide many of the things that Eisenhower should take responsibility for. For example, in one of his campaign speeches, the speech was released, and in it, Eisenhower praised George Marshall. You all read about the Marshall Plan. And he praised George Marshall. McCarthy didn't like George Marshall. That afternoon, McCarthy called Eisenhower and said he didn't like George Marshall. And when the speech was actually given that night, Eisenhower eliminated his praise of George Marshall. And when he did that, I thought, this is not the kind of person I want for president. I'm not sure I answered the question.
No. For a story, it was a wonderful answer with a lot of opportunities. I actually, because why I asked you that is about my own research about Avery Brundage, the head of the Olympic Committee, and who he was the one who said in 1972, after the attack of on the Israeli Olympic team, he said the games must go on. But Avery Brundage was in 1933 in Germany, talking to the Jewish sportsmen and women about their chance to compete, being a member of the German Olympic team. That's what the Americans wanted the Nazis to do. If you have a good Jewish sportsman, he should be a member of your team. And the people from the Jewish sports club complained. They said, listen, we don't have the facilities to train. We are not allowed to train with the non-Jewish sports people. And Brundage said, in my Chicago tennis club, Jews are not allowed either. So there's no problem with you. This was Avril Brundage. That's why we talked about that and thought, what is the situation? And as always, the situation is complicated. And the more you dig into it, it's getting more and more complicated. We would like to open the audience, the floor now for questions from the audience. I don't know if we have a working second microphone. Okay. We need someone maybe who... you will do it. Okay. So, questions to Robert.
I put everybody to sleep.
No, I had a good look at it. Everybody's awake.
No, thank you for being here. It was really great to hear you relate some of this in person. So I know I've spoken with him before, and I have read his book. And one question I asked him, which maybe other people might be wondering if you've read his book or you're considering reading his book, is how you were able to reconstruct like a lot of the memories and a lot of the dialogue that appears in your book, which was written in like when the 90s? Or...
Meine Herren, is there schlecht?
Sorry.
I will ask you to tell me.
So, mainly like how did you reconstruct? How did you reconstruct a lot of the dialogue and a lot of the memories that you had from that time? Because in your book they're very vivid and there's a lot of dialogue. And I'm curious as to how you reconstructed all of that. Did you have primary like materials, or you recorded it at the time, or?
Well, when Edmund Herman and I were discharged from the Army, I was discharged here in February of 1946, and I went back home and returned to college, to the university, and I didn't think about St. Etienne anymore. I mean, we did what we did, that was done, that's in the past. And you know, 20-year-old kid, you look for your own future. Ed Herman became an international financier, and so he was busy making money over those years. So this was in the past. But in the 1990s, the middle 1990s, there was so much Holocaust denial going on, particularly in the United States and in Canada. And I suddenly thought, you know, people don't know what happened. And St. Etienne is one of the examples of what happens when you allow hate and bigotry to go on. And even in a simple manner, you know, most of us, I bet, at one time or another, we'd be sitting around with a group of people, and someone would say, would tell a Jewish joke, or tell a Polish joke. You know, and we'd sit there and say, now we'd smile, instead of speaking up. Even simple things like that, we must pay attention to and stop. Because the moment you let hate or bigotry be stated, even in a joke, you're opening the gates to more hate and bigotry. Well, at that point, I decided I really have got to put down my memories of St. Etienne. Now, I did have a lot of documents, which I had saved, particularly from your grandfather, Dr. Grinberg's papers, and he got me English translations. I have some of the original in German, but English translations. And I began to go through them, and then I called Edward Herman, and I said, Ed, I'm putting together a memoir. And so I need to check with you as I write to see if I remember it correctly. So I was living in Boston at the time, and he was down in Florida. But we get on the phone, and when I began to remember something, I said, Ed, what do you remember? So everything I put down there, I at least had one person to verify, in addition to the documents. But that's why I wrote it at the time. I just felt people had, this is another example of what people should know when we let hate and bigotry take over.
I think one of the advantages of the book is that it's not a story like an American soldier appears at the gate of St. Cotillion and he brings a lot of food and everybody's happy and the army is great and everything is fine. But this complex, complicated story about it, that's what makes the book so readable and so and reliable. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So. I don't think I have the words to express the respect and gratitude that I feel towards you for doing what you did. I'm not sure that any of the things that my grandfather was able to accomplish here and all of the people who were working with him were able to accomplish, I don't know if they would have been able to do any of those things had it been for you and for Ed Herman. And I see so many lessons. And I've heard the story a few times now from you over the course of this week, and a few lessons to take home from it. And one, of course, is what you talked about, that you don't wait for, you know, the perfect plan or the perfect level of influence before you do something. You just try to do something because maybe you'll be able to pull it off. But it seems like there is a lot more there, too. I mean, because it wasn't just that. I mean, first of all, you were smart. You knew the scope of the problem and you knew that, you know, you couldn't just by stealing food from the, you know, from your own group, you wouldn't be able to solve the problem just by that. So then you had the courage to ask for help. And you had the courage to go public with it. And then finally, you knew somehow strategically that if you followed what you believed in and you held to your courage, even when you were being threatened by not just a general, but the general, you would pull through and you would make the impact that you wanted to make. So I guess my question is, it sounds like there are a lot of lessons that we can take away from this, and I'm wondering if you have others that you can point to that we can draw from in dealing with all the problems that we have in front of us today.
So are there more lessons to learn from the situation and your help in St. Cotillion other than you told us before?
Well, before I came to St. Cotillion, I knew a little bit about the death camps. In fact, the United States magazines and newspapers almost totally ignored what was happening. There were three newspapers that reported about the death camps. One was the New York Times. And the stories of the New York Times would be page 32 on the bottom, 50,000 people reported murdered so-and-so. They could have done much better, but the New York Times was owned by a Jewish family, and so they didn't want to be accused of favoring the Jews. The other newspaper that reported fully about the death camps was the communist paper, The Daily Worker. And the other newspaper was in New York, the Jewish Daily Forward. Virtually no others reported. So, in fact, if you didn't want to know what was happening, you didn't know. If you didn't want to know, you knew. So I had been reading those, at least sometimes, those three newspapers where I left, so I knew there was something. But I didn't know the extent of it. And I don't think very many of us did until the camps were open. Well, actually, we did. Henry Morgenthau, who was Jewish and Secretary of Treasury of the United States, received a report from someone in Denmark which listed details about the death camps. And he took it to President Roosevelt and said, please, we got to do something about it. And Roosevelt refused to do anything. To many people, particularly those of you in the States, we think of Roosevelt as kind of a god. I mean, he saved America from the Great Economic Depression. And well, I knew he was the only president that I knew by the time I went into the army, because he was president for 12, 14 years. But it was another part of America's neglect. Morgenthau tried for over a year to get Roosevelt to do something, and he didn't get him to do it at all. So there's so many different aspects of this that, you know, you see, I was not kind to the American military and government. Of course I wasn't, because, you know, if you love your country enough and you see it doing something wrong, you will do what you can to stop it.
I have mine. But I'm not sure what's on. So I would like to echo what Greenberg just said, but he said it so beautifully that I'm not going to try and say anything more than to thank you for what you did at the time and what you've done in terms of communicating all of this information over the last few decades since the 90s, arranging to have the film made, your book, all of these things that I think have had an enormous impact, and deservedly so because of everything that you did. So I won't say more than that, because Greg really said it beautifully. But I have a question. When you came to write the book in the 90s, did you consider trying to get hold of Zalman Greenberg? Did you have any idea where he was? I realized by then he was no longer alive, but Was that even a possibility in your mind?
Okay. Did you, when you decided to write the book in the 1990s, did you try to get in contact with Dr. Zalman Greenberg? Did you know about his fate? Did you try to contact him or the family?
No, I didn't. In fact, I was very neglectful in that, because after 1945, 1946, I simply went about my own life and paying no attention to anything else. I had heard that Dr. Greenberg had gone to Israel and had become head of a hospital there, but I didn't make contact. It was in the past. It was something that happened in the past. And so when I finally decided, I think I need to put this down. I just did from my own and Edward Herman's memory and from the documents I had. What I wanted to do was a first person account of what I saw, rather than to try to make it an expanded book of history.
Can you elaborate a little bit, please, about the leaders of the Jewish community in the United States, how they react about your action?
How did the leaders of the Jewish communities in the United States react to the letter? You asked about the letter.
Yeah.
Do you have any reactions from the communities?
No, I don't. I never had any reactions, except in the year 2000, the Holocaust Museum in New York, in Washington, D.C., had a special conference on the survivors. that is up to that time, very few museums, Holocaust museums, were dealing with what happened to the survivors when, after the war. It was always up to the liberation of the camps. And so I spoke at that conference, which happened to be sponsored mainly by the Joint Distribution Committee, the JDC. And the speeches I gave told how the JDC was totally neglectful and did nothing for the people there. Then I got reaction, I was at that conference.
But there was no reaction from Jewish communities to the letter. Not from the, not only talking about the joint.
I don't know. I mean, the reaction from various communities was that got 1,200 packages. But I don't know otherwise, because we wouldn't know. Well, I guess to an extent we would know that our individual parents or friends who got the letters, some of them wrote back and said, your letter was very powerful and tore at our hearts and we're going to do something. And that's what Edward and I were happy about, that something would be done.
Was there something in your upbringing that made you the way you were, fighting for justice, fighting for people who needed help?
Was there something in your upbringing that made you fight for justice, that made you the person that reacted as a young soldier of 19 years old? You said in your book that you were brought up in a Jewish community but not very aware of it, kind of.
No, that's right. No, I did not have a religious upbringing in any way. But you know, you don't have to have a formal upbringing in anything to believe in something. And I remember, part of it was that I was a young child during the Great Depression in New York, and I saw people suffering. The poor people were the ones who suffered from the economy. And I remember outside my apartment house, if you didn't pay the rent, what they did was to take all your goods and furniture and throw it out in the street. And anybody could pick it up and take it. And I saw that happen frequently. I thought, this is horrible. And I saw, and once, it had a great impression on me. I was near an elevated train station. And they had these big iron pillars holding it up. And there was a man there who was a neighborhood. And he probably was drunk. He probably had something to drink, a lot to drink. But he couldn't feed his family. And I saw him one evening going up to this stanchion and banging it with his fists like this, crying out. And I thought, if this is what our economic system can do, this is horrible. So I suppose a number of things as a child, seeing these kinds of things, my belief is, be afraid to die until you've made the world a little better than you found it. Be ashamed to die, not afraid. Be ashamed to die.
You use two forms of medium to record these events. One is the written word, surviving the Americans, and the miracle at St. Vitalian. Did you do the two simultaneously is one question, or perhaps the movie followed the book, and which do you think was a better form of medium to spread the word?
You did two. You did actually two things, two media. You wrote a book and you did a film. And the question is, which had, what do you think which had a bigger impact?
I never thought of that. The book got a fair amount of circulation. But unfortunately, I had a falling out with the editor. And so he stopped production of it almost 20 years ago. At that point, Professor John Michalczyk made the documentary film. And that has been going around, and I think that has had more of a powerful effect because people could literally see. He got some wonderful background shots and stock footage, and I think he made an excellent film. And
actually, when I appear, like before groups, not this is a very special group, but before groups, what I usually do now is simply show the film first, and then we talk and have questions.
And we see it.
I'm a writer, so I want to say the book is the greatest. On the other hand, films, as you know, people don't read it anymore. Everything is visual.
And as you remember, in Shemot 17:14, the Lord says, write and not do a film.
Okay.
Well, I very much appreciate you all taking your time to see. I appreciate you taking the time to see things.
One more question.
All I can say is, in the future, if we have anything like this, it should be St. Attilian like it was from 1946 to 48, and we must do everything we can do to stop there being more St. Attilians with more survivors of any kind of prejudice.
I heard someone mentioning, can we see the film? I'm just wondering, is that possible to see the film?
Is it possible to see the movie? Do we have it?
I don't know.
Yes. Well, I have a copy with me. Father Cyril can arrange it.
Yeah, sure. You have it before. If you want film. To. Yeah, sure. Where do you have the film? The film, where is it?
Yes.
So we need the film to show it.
No, I have not the film, but the disc.
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine. CD. Yeah, that's okay. Yeah. So, if you tell us your room number.